This is the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about leadership and management with government executives and thought leaders who are truly changing the way government does business. Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and leadership fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Today, we'll be exploring critical insights on leadership, disruption, and transformation in an era defined by unprecedented change. We'll hear from two remarkable thought leaders who bring both practical advice and deep wisdom to these challenges. First up is Terrence Mowry, founder and CEO of Hack Future Lab and author of The Upside of Disruption, The Path to Leading and Thriving in the Unknown. My second guest is Scott D. Anthony, professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth University and author of Epic Disruptions, 11 Innovations That Shaped Our Modern World. Both leaders offer strategies on how to navigate uncertainty, embrace change, and drive transformation in an era where disruption is accelerating. Through their own words from our interviews, we'll explore the mindset, strategies, and courage required to lead in the unknown. Let's begin by understanding the landscape we're operating in. Our first theme explores how the nature and pace of disruption has fundamentally changed. What are leaders facing today that's different from previous eras? Terrence Mowry paints a vivid picture of the challenge facing today's leaders.
Change used to happen as a breeze. Now it feels like a Category 5 typhoon.
Mowry isn't just speaking metaphorically. He backs this up with research showing the preparation gap leaders face.
Disruption comes wrapped up as risk and reward. And, you know, risk and reward always travel in the same elevator. And we sometimes forget that.
And he points to specific disruptors on the horizon.
There are some big disruptors on the horizon right now. So, for example, AI is a here-to-stay, secular, structural megatrend. Another one would be decarbonization. And another one would be ethical impact.
Professor Scott Anthony brings a historian's perspective to this question. His book examines 11 epic disruptions spanning from gunpowder to artificial intelligence. Here's how he frames what we can learn from history.
This isn't meant to be the top 11. This is not meant to be the definitive guide to disruptive innovation. It's meant to be a story. So I look for things that also would be interesting stories to tell, which is why Florence Nightingale and Julia Child, who I think were absolutely epic disruptors, made the cut because in addition to that, they also just had delicious stories to tell. And as you go through those stories, there's three big themes that emerge. Disruption changes the world for better and sometimes for worse. Disruption is predictably unpredictable, and disruption rewards people who are patient and persevere.
Anthony emphasizes that understanding disruption starts with getting the definition right.
A disruption takes something that was complicated and expensive and makes it simple and affordable. It changes market dynamics. It drives dynamic growth.
This brings us to a critical insight that Anthony emphasizes throughout his work. Disruption isn't really about the technology itself. Let me share what he discovered about how disruption actually works. When you study these topics, disruption across history, patterns emerge about what makes them truly transformative. For government leaders, this is essential to understand. Disruption isn't just about adopting new technology. It's about fundamentally rethinking how you deliver value and serve citizens. Before we go further, we need to address something important. The word disruption itself is often misunderstood. Professor Anthony explains why getting this definition right matters, and he shares something that his mentor, Clay Christensen, came to regret.
You know, if you ask Clay Christensen about regrets, the biggest regret he would have, aside from being dealt a very bad hand with health, it's a separate discussion, his biggest regret about his research is that he picked the word disruption to describe the phenomena he observed. And the reason he regretted that is disruption is a word that is just laden with meaning.
Anthony continues with why this matters psychologically.
If I say the word disruption, you probably will think about a time a trip was dictionarily disrupted because something happened with a flight delay or whatever. You think of something bad that happened in your life. And indeed, your mouth kind of curls when you say the word. So the biggest mistake people make is they think disruption is something that's a big thing that's bad. And in Christensen's research and what I talk about in the book, a disruption is a very particular form of innovation. I'll say it again. It takes things that were complicated and expensive and makes them simple and affordable, changes dynamics, and drives explosive growth.
Why does this precision in definition matter? Anthony explains the practical implications for different types of leaders.
Why does that matter? Well, that particular form of innovation, when you identify it, if you're a business leader, you say, I've got something that has the potential to really go and shape a market. If you're a market incumbent, you have to be a little bit worried because history shows you that if an entrant comes after you with something that disrupts the status quo, it's going to be really hard for you to respond, and you have to think really carefully about what you do.
And for government specifically, Anthony lays out a comprehensive framework.
If you're government, there's a range of implications. Number one, you need to understand what are the disruptions that are going to reshape markets. That can affect everything from how do we think about antitrust policy to how do we think about consumer welfare. You need to think about own internal operations. What are new innovations that are coming that are going to change the way that we do our work? And you need to think about how are we going to create the conditions where we maximize the upside of disruption and we minimize the downside.
Terrence Mowry echoes the need to see both sides of disruption, the upside and the challenge.
And one of the big themes of my book, The Upside of Disruption, is really answering this question, how do we turn these disruptors, these mega trends, into practical milestones?
Both our guests emphasize that responding to disruption starts with a fundamental shift in how leaders think. Let's explore what that mindset shift looks like, starting with how leaders need to rethink their entire approach to the status quo. Terrence Mowry challenges us to rethink the very purpose of leadership.
Today's challenges can't be solved with yesterday's mindset. So what I mean by that is often we're trapped in industrial age mindsets. We're preservers of the status quo rather than challengers of the status quo.
And he emphasizes that this requires moving from conformity to courage.
And what we need right now in this world of sameness and commoditization, where it's easier and easier to imitate each other on technology, on speed, on scope and scale, we actually need willful contrarianism. We need courage over conformity.
Mowry continues with what this means practically.
We're able to see the world differently. We ask the questions that are not being asked. We say what's not being said. And that doesn't happen enough in boardrooms.
Professor Anthony echoes this emphasis on mindset, but he breaks it down into specific observable behaviors. Here are the key patterns he found across 11 epic disruptions he studied. These aren't abstract concepts. They're concrete behaviors that anyone can develop and practice.
So let me explain those behaviors. There are five of them. Number one, the disruptive innovators are curious. They're questioning the status quo. They're asking, why are we doing it this way? How might we do it differently? They're seeing things through a different set of lenses.
The second behavior focuses on the people you serve.
Behavior two. Disruptive innovators are obsessed with customers. They're trying to figure out unique problems to solve. They're putting themselves in the shoes of the customers, asking, how can we make their lives better?
The third behavior might surprise you. It's about collaboration, not lone genius.
Behavior number three, disruptive innovators are collaborative. Note that I said Julia Child had two co-authors. She worked with lots of different people. She had help from a friend, Davis DeVacho, from her husband, Paul Child. She recognized one of the timeless principles of innovation. Magic happens at intersections when different mindsets and backgrounds collide.
The fourth behavior addresses something critical for government leaders, dealing with uncertainty.
Behavior number four, disruptive innovators are adept in ambiguity. They recognize success is not a straight line. It's not you come up with a plan and then you act. It's you come up with an idea that you test, that you fail, that you learn.
Anthony illustrates this point with a vivid example from the work of Chef Julia Childs.
Julia Child was a master at this. When coming up with the recipe to allow people to cook a baguette at home, she went through 30 different experiments, used 284 pounds of flour until she figured out what would work.
And the fifth behavior speaks to persistence.
Behavior number five, disruptive innovators persist through adversity. Julia Child was not an overnight success. There are no overnight successes. 1951 is when she teams up with Simca Beck and Louisette Berthold to do the book that ultimately became Mastering the Art of French Cooking. It was supposed to be done in 1953. It came out in 1961. It took 10 years, three different publishers, and two near-death experiences.
Notice the overlap between both leaders and his example: curiosity, courage, and persistence. Mowry elaborates on the critical importance of questions in developing this mindset.
Questions, catalytic questions, new types of questions, one of the most underutilized skill sets and mindsets today. If you think of, you know, our kids or grandchildren or nephews and nieces, they ask so many questions when they're young. In fact, the ratio of questions to answers is like 10 to 1. By the time we leave college or university or start our first job, you know, we're told to be silent.
And he offers a practical approach for leaders.
We ask the questions that are not being asked. We say what's not being said. And that doesn't happen enough in boardrooms.
Mowry introduces a powerful tool he uses with leadership teams. It's called Future Fridays.
We introduced a Future Friday once a quarter. And a Future Friday really gave people the bandwidth, the energy, the psychological capital to look ahead.
One of the most provocative themes that emerges from both conversations is this: success isn't just about learning new things. It's about unlearning old things. Let's explore why this is so difficult, yet so essential. Terence Mowry makes a bold statement about what separates good leaders from great ones.
Good leaders learn and great leaders unlearn.
He explains why this is psychologically so challenging and why expertise itself can become a trap.
But there's a risk as well. Being too expert can lead to silo thinking. The problems we face in the world right now are intractable. They require cross-pollination, polymathy.
Mowry emphasizes that we are operating with outdated mental models.
You know, we need to move from fixed to fluidity, from transactional thinking to transformational thinking, from wait and see to explore and discover. So it is a mindset shift. And the future is not just about technology or trends, although it seems that way sometimes. It's about mindsets and choices as well.
He introduces another powerful concept, the half-life of everything.
For example, the half-life of skills now is about 5 years, and for technical skills is about 2.5 years. Half-life of a competitive advantage of an S&P 500 company is probably 18 months or less now.
Professor Scott Anthony found this same pattern when studying historical disruptions. He discovered what he calls the leader's dilemma, and he illustrates this point with one of Clay Christensen's favorite examples.
So this is one of the things that struck me so much when I was first exposed to Clay's research, this counterintuitive nature of it. So let me give an example from the book, probably Clay's favorite example, the example of steel mini mills. So in the 1960s, Bethlehem Steel, along with other steel producers, is at the top of its game. 1962, it goes and invests $4 billion in today's terms to go and open up a great big integrated mill in Burns Harbor in Indiana. And this thing is a masterpiece.
But then something changed that Bethlehem Steel did not see coming.
In the late 1960s, a company called Nucor comes up with a very different model to make steel. It's called a steel mini mill. It doesn't cost $4 billion to create a plant. It costs $4 million. They're a lot smaller. They use electric arc furnaces. They take scrap steel. They melt it. They turn it into low-quality products that are used in very basic applications. But because it's a smaller footprint, they do it cheaper.
Here's where the innovator's dilemma emerges. Where doing what looks right leads you astray.
Now, what Bethlehem Steel should have done is said, let's invest in the mini mill technology. Let's have a full spectrum offering where we can have integrated mills to serve our most demanding customers, mini mills to go and efficiently serve the lowest tiers of the market. That's the thing that it should have done. Those were the right choices, but they didn't look like the right choices.
Anthony explains the psychology of why the right decision felt wrong to the executives at Bethlehem Steel.
The right choices to Bethlehem Steel look like, let's invest in higher margin, more profitable opportunities up market. As the mini mills are beginning to nip at our heels at the lowest tiers of the market, let's get out of that market. It appears rational to do it because the attacker has a cost advantage. The problem, the technology the mini mill started with wasn't very good, but it got better and better and better.
And here's the tragic conclusion that seems to play out again and again in business history.
They were able to serve more and more demanding marketeers. By the time it became obvious to Bethlehem Steel and other integrated steel producers that they had missed the mark, it was too late to respond. So in that moment, the right decisions look like the wrong ones. The wrong decisions look like the right ones. This is the essence of the innovator's dilemma.
So how do you know what to unlearn? Anthony offers guidance that applies directly to government leaders today.
Now, if you apply this to the world of government today, one of the big challenges is we have a world that is obsessed with short-term impact, that is obsessed with, are we going to get the next vote? Are we going to have our citizens happy in the next day, week, month?
And his prescription?
It requires us looking differently at things, requiring recognizing things that look inferior, things that look not very good today, will be in the mainstream tomorrow. It requires really having long-term orientation in a short-term obsessed world. That's not an easy thing to do.
You can't plan your way to success. You have to experiment your way forward. We'll explore this topic and so much more on the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Navigating Disruption with authors Terrence Mowry and Scott Anthony. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. Let's turn to action. Both our guests emphasize that in uncertain times, you can't plan your way to success. You have to experiment your way forward. But how do you create the conditions where experimentation can thrive? Terrence Mowry frames this around the importance of starting before you're ready.
Start before you're ready. If you wait for 100% certainty on anything you want to do in your professional life or your personal life, it's going to be too late. We need to transition from wait and hope to challenge and grow, from fixed mindsets to iterative, experimental mindsets, where you get to test out a hypothesis, test out an idea, test out an assumption. This is a far better way to live.
Mowry emphasizes the organizational conditions needed for experimentation.
Next time you're in a meeting and you want to energize that meeting, but also help people navigate disruption, help empower people to scale, help people change from within, start the meeting with some questions and say, look, guys, let's think about some of these disruptors on the horizon.
And he describes a powerful questioning process.
Just ask questions and just generate questions for about 15 minutes. And then look at those questions as a team and pick one or two or maximum three questions that really move the dial.
Mowry introduces his framework for building this capacity. He calls it DARE, and it provides a practical structure for leaders.
It's really four mindset shifts. The first one stands for data, and it's leading with AI. The second is agility. And that is all about this idea that great leaders learn, but the best leaders unlearn. Number three is risk, the idea that not taking a risk is a risk when uncertainty and disruption is high. And the final one of the DARE framework is the E, stands for evolution. And that's all about trust.
On the risk dimension specifically, Mowry offers this counterintuitive insight.
Not taking a risk when volatility is high, when the ratio of assumptions to knowledge is growing, you actually have to take more risks at a mathematical level.
He explains this mathematical framing.
You know, you want the ratio of assumptions to knowledge to be at one, but it's not. It's growing every day. We have multidimensional assumptions, assumptions that no longer hold true, assumptions that haven't been tested, assumptions that haven't even been spoken about.
Professor Anthony introduces a crucial concept, learning when to persevere and when to pull the plug. He shares a powerful example about Procter & Gamble's development of disposable diapers.
1956, he asked Bob Duncan to go into disposable diapers. Now, at the time, 80% of U.S. households had at least one disposable diaper, but they only made up 1% of diaper changes because the quality was so bad. So the team gets to work. 1958, they fail a test market. The technology isn't right. 1960 and 62, they fail two more test markets. The pricing isn't right.
Why did they keep going after three failures? Anthony explains.
Why did P&G persevere in the face of all these failures? Well, it was clear they were working on a problem that was worth solving. 80% of households had a disposable diaper. It was only 1% of uses. Why? Product quality was bad. The pricing wasn't right. The first failure of P&G was the technology. The vision still held. The second failure was the price was too high. The vision still held.
And here's the principle that applies to any innovation effort.
When you are targeting something that is a fundamental problem, when the consumer or customer or citizen has demonstrated repeatedly this matters to them one way or another, and you just can't get the technology or pricing or other aspects of the model right, those are times you keep pushing.
But Anthony explains when to stop.
The consumers had told P&G that, but once the actual product existed, the consumer said, you know what? This actually isn't something that really matters that much to me and carrying multiple diapers because if the baby poops, I still have to do a full diaper change. That's just not worth it to me. So when you see the sign that the problem isn't that important, that's when you pull the plug.
Mowry brings this back to the day-to-day reality leaders face, where experimentation often gets squeezed out by bureaucracy.
The power of this is that if you stop even just for 4 minutes a day to ask catalytic questions, new questions to old problems, new questions to new problems, that's 24 hours of new questions a year.
One of the biggest challenges leaders face is this. How do you optimize today's business while simultaneously creating tomorrow's opportunities? This is especially challenging in government, where resources are constrained and accountability is high. Terrence Mowry frames this around creating space to look at different time horizons.
To look ahead over the next few years, but also over the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, stretching that horizon to say, you know, what do we hold to be true?
And he offers a framework for thinking about what's changing and what's not.
When we think about our industry, when we think about how we create value, what's enduring? What's not going to change? What's emerging? What's new? You know, emerging technologies, for example. And what's eroding? What's going off like yogurt in the fridge? Old assumptions, old business models, old ways of thinking.
Mowry emphasizes this as a catalytic question.
And so this question of what's enduring, what's emerging, and what's eroding is what I call a catalytic question for turning disruption into tailwinds, amplifying humility over hubris, and giving everybody a sense of alignment and empowerment and a point of view on the future and how to turn that future into value.
Professor Scott Anthony has thought deeply about this challenge. He calls it dual transformation, and it directly addresses the government leader's dilemma.
You know, the core idea in dual transformation is pretty simple. Disruption is coming. You have to transform, fundamental change in state or substance. And if you're going to do that, if you're in an organization, it's not a one-shot deal. It's a two-shot deal, hence the dual in the title, which means you have to reinvent today to adapt to the disruptive change, and you have to create tomorrow.
And he emphasizes what this means for modern leadership.
And that's really the essence of what modern leadership is. So the book, to me, reinforced what disruption is, showed me in starker contrast both the power of it and some of the downsides to it, helped to further refine the patterns that make it predictably unpredictable, and showcased again how it requires patience.
Let me share a practical example from my conversation with Terrence Mowry about what stands in the way of this kind of transformation. And it's something government leaders know all too well.
My research shows that excess bureaucracy, because we know there are different types of bureaucracy, and there are certain types of bureaucracy that are absolutely essential. Regulation, governance, compliance, health and safety. I'm not debating that. I'm talking about excess bureaucracy.
He defines what he means by excess bureaucracy.
What I mean by excess bureaucracy is best practices that have become broken practices, but we still do them. I'm talking about 1 in 3 meetings around the world that's considered a complete waste of time, but we still do it. I'm talking about the 30,000 emails a year that each of us will deal with, but about 60% are not relevant.
Let's talk about perhaps the most pressing disruption facing leaders today, artificial intelligence. Both my guests have thought deeply about what AI means for leadership and organizations. Terrence Mowry has developed a fascinating framework for thinking about AI. He breaks its evolution into three phases.
The three waves of AI, well, the first one is known as excitement or exuberance. And what I mean by that is, a third of VC venture funding going into AI startups and AI infrastructure.
He describes where we are now.
Phase two is the experimentation phase. And that's where we're at right now. It's really starting to create your own use cases of AI, starting to test out large language models and large action models, and really start to experiment with proof of concepts of how we can actually scale AI as a tailwind.
And where we're heading.
The next stage, the final stage of this AI evolution journey, which I kind of cast out to the next 7 to 10 years, will be what's called the embedded phase. So excitement, experimentation, and embedded. And embedded means that it becomes invisible. I truly believe that great technology should be invisible, zero friction. You shouldn't really be aware that it's around. And we're not there yet.
Mowry reframes what success means in the age of AI.
The payoff, the net benefit of this reductionism drive has been 9 out of 10 people reporting more energy, more focus, more engagement, more happiness, but also more ROI. And I don't mean return on investment. I mean return on intelligence.
He elaborates on this concept.
Being disruptive is about ultimately about doing more work that matters, where we get to solve problems, our biggest problems, and where we get to put our brains into action. And I've framed a new post-AI metric, return on intelligence.
Professor Anthony explains why AI is so uniquely disruptive.
And that's the thing about artificial intelligence, because it is a general purpose technology, because it is so accessible through the large language models that have emerged in the past few years, you have usage like we have never seen before. You have applicability in sectors of the economy and world like we have never seen before. And it's still incredibly early days.
But he also expresses concern about an unleashed approach to technology.
The thing that gives me pause is I think the approach the world is following right now is, hey, let's just let technology work its way out. And history teaches that that's not the way that you actually get through what I call in the book, the messy middle of disruptive change. In fact, there is a big role for government, for regulation, for rules, for boundaries to help make sure that technologies develop in the right way.
Anthony emphasizes the democratizing potential, but also the responsibility that comes with it.
One of the great powers of generative AI is democratization, allowing more people to consume more information in more places.
Let's turn to a topic that resonates with every government leader and dive deeper. That is bureaucracy. Both guests emphasize that you can't innovate when you're drowning in process and red tape. Terrence Mowry introduces what he calls the BMI, and he doesn't mean body mass index.
The biggest though, Michael, is what I call BMI. And for our listeners' benefit, I don't mean body mass index. What I mean is bureaucratic misery index.
He shares a striking example.
What I mean by excess bureaucracy is best practices that have become broken practices, but we still do them. I'm talking about 1 in 3 meetings around the world that's considered a complete waste of time, but we still do it.
And he gives a specific government example that illustrates the cost.
I was at San Francisco City Hall. They're looking for firefighters right now. There's a shortage. And it takes an average of 232 days to organize a first interview for a firefighter. Can you believe that? That's BMI.
Mowry emphasizes why this matters so much.
We have less time, literally, to focus on creative work, meaningful work, work that creates value. And we spend most of our time in the week on transactional work, low-value work, soul-sucking work. So the BMI is a really big deal. Growth creates complexity. Complexity can kill growth.
He shares a powerful example of an organization that tackled this head-on, NASA.
So at NASA, they've committed to a sort of agenda of reductionism. What I mean by that is, and this is disruptive, by the way, because reductionism is basically saying we need to eliminate we have the humility to recognize that some of the ways that we're working at scale are no longer functioning. In fact, they're doing more harm than good.
Professor Scott Anthony reinforces this with a practical example from Singapore's government that shows what's possible.
One of the things that really struck me in Singapore, which is, of course, a very unique place, a very unique structure, but the degree to which the government was willing to run very interesting experiments. As an example, the central bank, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, about 8 years ago now, before it was kind of a cool thing to do, they launched a regulatory sandbox for fintech, for financial technology. It was safeguarded from the financial system, so it could not bring the system down, but it was a space, A, for companies to learn about new technologies, and B, the regulator to understand what things like crypto would actually look like if they were deployed.
His conclusion challenges the assumption that government can't innovate.
I think governments need to do a lot more things like this. Nothing stops them from doing it aside from their own perceptions of what their limits are.
Let's address something specific to our government audience. Government agencies and departments face unique constraints, public accountability, procurement rules, and risk aversion, to name a few. Professor Scott Anthony first acknowledges this reality, but then challenges its assumptions.
Then it's also important to acknowledge that I have learned a universal truth from 25 years of studying disruption. Everybody thinks it is uniquely hard for them. So if I go to anybody, they will say, yes, but my organization is regulated and therefore I can't. Or my organization is not regulated and therefore there's too much competition. Or we have public shareholders and they're putting pressure. Or we have private shareholders and they don't allow us to go fast. Whatever.
His advice is direct.
Sometimes there's some truth to it. But the reality is, this is just hard work. And many times when I hear people say that, they're just trying to find someone else to blame. So yes, acknowledge it, but don't allow that to be the thing that stops you. Think about what you can do within the constraints with which you operate.
And here's Anthony's counterintuitive insight about constraints that should give government leaders hope.
One of the findings that I think is really interesting to highlight, if you look at the relationship between creativity and constraints, people think they are inversely related. In other words, if you want creativity, remove barriers, remove constraints. But actually, the research shows that constraints enable creativity. Just think about this as a metaphor. If you have no constraints or no filters or nothing that blocks or focuses light, what do you get? You get a really dim glow. If you focus it, you get a laser that can do some really powerful things. So used properly, constraints can actually be liberating, can help you see things that you couldn't otherwise see.
Terrence Mowry speaks to the reality that many government leaders face. They feel stuck, but Mowry reframes this.
And we have to be careful here. There's not a prescriptive answer to a disruption mindset. If you're VC-backed in Silicon Valley, it's going to be second nature. Disruptibility is going to be part of the DNA. If you're in a government agency, if you're an NGO, if you're in a non-for-profit, if you're in a more conservative industry, well, you know, there might be more risk aversion and more fear of change, fear of the unknown. And there's a rational reason for that. You know, our brains are hardwired for safety and security and certainty.
He emphasizes that understanding this doesn't mean accepting it.
So sometimes we protect the status quo, even though it's harming us at a personal level or a professional level or a strategic level.
One of the most common questions government leaders ask is, how do we balance the need for innovation with the imperative of reliability? This is especially critical when you're responsible for citizen services that people depend on every day. Professor Scott Anthony offers an answer through the Toyota Production System, a framework that proves these aren't competing priorities.
So if we want to make sure that things are as reliable as possible, if we're Toyota and we want our production system to be as efficient as possible, we need to constantly be innovating. We need to constantly be curious. We need to constantly be probing. We need to constantly be thinking about what we can do differently. This is the essence of the Toyota production system. Anybody has the ability to pull what's called the Andon cord, to say something's not working, something is not right. Let's stop, let's investigate, let's figure out how to do this better.
And here's the principle that reframes the entire question.
Things that look like either ors can in fact be both ands if we find ways to reframe them. And that's what I think we need to do, say that innovation and reliability actually can be very symbiotic with each other.
Terrence Mowry echoes this theme of reframing apparent contradictions. He talks about shifting from a yes, but to a yes and mindset.
Yes, but means becoming too brittle, problem before possibility. Yes, and possibility before problem, and means more adaptability, fluidity, humility to embrace the future and turn risk into reward.
And he explains the difference.
Yes, but problem before possibility. Yes, and we see possibility before problem. And there's this expertise, our dilemma, that when we wear an expert hat all the time, and of course we want to be experts and expertise is important, but there's a risk as well. Being too expert can lead to silo thinking.
Anthony reinforces how this dual transformation mindset can be the essence of modern leadership.
Dual transformation is about understanding and responding to disruptive change. Epic Disruptions gives you the tools, the mindset, the approaches, and sometimes the stories and confidence to be able to go and do it.
Welcome back to a special edition, The Business of Government Hour, Navigating Disruption, with authors Terrence Mowry and Scott Anthony. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. As we move towards conclusion, let's focus on practical frameworks our listeners can implement immediately. Both authors offer concrete tools you can use starting today. Terrence Mowry emphasizes starting with the power of questions.
Pick one or two, or maximum three questions that really move the dial, that shift your perspective, that perhaps put you out, stretch you out of your comfort zone or get you out of your cognitive box and get you thinking differently, and pick those questions and then dive into those questions.
And he reminds us of the mathematics behind small daily actions.
You know, when volatility is high, when disruption is high, when today's the slowest it'll ever be in our lifetime and competition can come from anywhere, questions are the answer.
Professor Anthony identifies five disruptive behaviors as a personal assessment tool. These are behaviors anyone can develop.
Number one, the disruptive innovators are curious. They're questioning the status quo. Behavior two, disruptive innovators are obsessed with customers. Behavior number three, disruptive innovators are collaborative. Behavior number four, disruptive innovators are adept in ambiguity. Behavior number five, disruptive innovators persist through adversity.
Anthony emphasizes that these aren't superhuman qualities. They're observable behaviors that emerged across all his research.
Those people are like you and me. They get up every morning, they go to sleep every night, et cetera, et cetera. They do amazing things, and they have some parts of them that are amazing, but it's not something that is unattainable for anyone.
We've covered enormous ground today, weaving together insights from authors Terrence Mowry and Professor Scott D. Anthony. Let me leave you with the key takeaways that emerge from both conversations. First, disruption is accelerating, but patterns exist. As Anthony showed us, the fundamental dynamics remain consistent, and we can learn from history. Second, mindset trumps method. Both leaders emphasize curiosity over conformity, questions over answers, and courage over comfort. Third, unlearning is as critical as learning. What got you here won't get you there. Fourth, experimentation is non-negotiable. You must experiment with smart, affordable bets that generate learning quickly. Fifth, manage across horizons. Defend today while creating tomorrow. Flip your time allocation toward the future. Sixth, eliminate bureaucracy ruthlessly. 77% of leaders know they're suffocating their people with unnecessary processes. This is self-inflicted and fixable. Seventh, courage is a daily choice. The work you do each day either feeds your fears or your courage. Leadership is about making a choice. For government leaders, your mission to serve the public good does not change. But how you fulfill that mission must evolve. The leaders who will succeed are those who embrace uncertainty, challenge assumptions, create psychological safety for experimentation, and never lose sight of the human beings, citizens and employees, at the center of transformation. Remember Terrence Mowry's challenge: when volatility is high, not taking a risk is the biggest risk. And Professor Scott Anthony's lesson from history: the future is not something that happens to you. It's something that humans create one courageous choice at a time. Both authors remind us that behind every disruption, behind every transformation, are human beings like you making choices. You have the five behaviors of disruptors: curiosity, customer obsession, collaboration, comfort with ambiguity, and persistence. You have frameworks like DARE and dual transformation. You have examples from history. The question is, will you use them? Thank you for joining us for the special edition of the Business of Government Hour on Navigating Disruption. Be sure to join us next time for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government leadership and its effectiveness. Until then, subscribe, download, and listen to the entire interview at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, or on your favorite podcast app. And as always, at businessofgovernment.org. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.